It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kingsley, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations.
And I'm Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Communication Studies at IUPUI.
Today's conversation is really interesting. We're going to focus on LIDAR, and if you don't know what that is, you will find that out. Remote sensing, visualization, what lies beneath the surface, archaeological landscapes, artifacts, and seeing the invisible. Krista, do you mind introducing our guests?
We have with us two special guests today. Please welcome Dr. Jeremy Wilson, Associate Professor in the Department of Anthropology at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, my institution, and Dr. Alex Elvis Badillo, Assistant Professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Systems at Indiana State University. Thanks for being here, both of you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for inviting us.
It's really great to have both of you. And when I'm thinking about a lot of times, archaeology, you know, it's something paleontology and archaeology, I think, is what some 5-6-year-olds go, I want to be that when I grow up. And I think they think of fossils and dinosaurs and kinds of things. But how is archaeology really differing from something like paleontology?
Sure. I could take or give you my take on it, at least. So archaeologists create historical narratives or stories about the past based upon material remains. And so, as you mentioned before, this includes the analysis of artifacts from sites and, of course, the excavation of them before that.
And oftentimes those two things do get conflated, even, you know, with our students at the university level, you know, paleontology and archaeology often, oh, let's go dig some dinosaurs. And it's really not about that. It's, you know, it's a subfield of anthropology, at least the way we kind of think of it here in the US, and that studies humans. And so that's kind of, if it has to do with humans, we study it. And so if it's, there are certain specializations within archaeology, like zooarchaeology, where they study animals, but that usually relates to humans and the telling stories about the past.
That's really great. The idea of telling something stories, which really is what it is, in a way, you have to get a good guess, don't you, Alex, at it? I mean, you don't, there is science in it, but you all still are trying to fill in a little bit of, wouldn't you say, maybe a little bit of fiction with the nonfiction just to make it a story?
Yeah, definitely. I kind of think of the way archaeology, at least for me, you know, we use the scientific method to do this data collection. We approach it with the research design and we collect our data, we do our analyses. And then there's the interpretive work of what does it actually mean as we look at our data. And so it is just a way of knowing the past. That's kind of the way that I see it. And there is that interpretive work layered on top of the scientific foundation.
Yeah, and I would just add that, you know, archaeologists use analogy all the time. And so when we look at the humans around us, whether it be our children, our family members writ large, or even our community, you know, we can see how they behave on a day-to-day basis. And it turns out it's actually pretty predictable, right? So in archaeology, we study people's trash and how they consume things. And so we can see that today, and we can apply some of those kind of analogies to past societies.
The things that sticks out to me that both of you have referred to in this space is, the notion of storytelling and how storytelling and narrative become a really important part of being able to construct the past. Can you talk a little bit more about how the science that you do is informed by some of these predictable narratives that we know that humans engage in? And Jeremy, maybe we'll start with you.
Yeah, sure. And so when we go out to an archaeological site, whether we're using remote sensing to kind of predict what's beneath the ground surface or not, what I always tell the students is to think about what it was like to live there. And through that kind of embodiment of what it meant to live, say, 800 years ago in a Native American village, they can begin to understand the behaviors of these individuals on a day-to-day basis, where they would have discarded certain materials as opposed to others, where they might have stored food, where they might have cooked it, and so on and so forth.
And like, for instance, with settlement pattern research, you know, you're often trying to predict where people were living in the past. And so there's actually an interesting activity that I do sometimes with kids. And, you know, we look on a big map and we try to say, okay, where were we going to find where people were living in the past? And the map usually has a river running right through the middle of it. And oftentimes the student, you know, the students or the kids will actually say, oh, right here next to the river. And you ask, well, why is that? And, you know, just kind of knowing that humans need water to live, they'll say, well, they need water, so they're going to live near the water. Or maybe they'll say, oh, well, they need fish or some sort of resource to eat. But I always like to flip it on its head and say, well, what if these were people that really respected high places? You know, it's part of their cosmology. Maybe these places really high up in the mountains actually meant something to them, you know, and then that kind of changes that predictability. That's what I like about archaeology, is that culture sometimes is unpredictable, but there's still some sort of predictability within it.
That's a really good point, the idea that we think about the sort of material things, right? The things that we need, like water and fish and, you know, food sources, those kinds of things. But you're right to say that those sort of cultural pieces can sometimes take us in new and interesting directions. When we think about art, the role of art, the role of beauty in being able to drive folks' behavior, can you talk a little bit about, you know, we've got obviously the kind of day-to-day things, but humans have always sought out opportunities to see beauty in the natural world, to sort of experience beauty in their day-to-day objects. How does that play into how you help your students think about the role of culture in human behavior?
It's a good question. I'm still kind of mulling it over. So how do you kind of understand what you're asking here is, how does art in the past influence human behavior?
Yeah, I think so. I'm thinking about, I'll share, I have a friend that is a functional artist. So all of the objects that she makes have a purpose. And that purpose might be everything from your sofa to a spoon that you use in the kitchen. And the idea that we all as humans want to experience something that is beautiful and at the same time often useful. And so I'm thinking that, you know, if you're talking about a group of people who are very connected to high places, the types of day-to-day experiences that they have would likely be informed by that belief structure that they have in looking for the beauty in living in a place like that.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating when you go to an archaeological site and think about how humans have transformed that landscape on a broad scale. And of course, Alex can really speak to this in terms of his work in Oaxaca in Mexico, but even here in the Midwest, you know, we see that Native American groups fundamentally transformed these kind of floodplain landscapes and built up these villages with platform mounds that had structures on top of them, with central plazas that had these large kind of cedar posts. And so in building these landscapes, right, in transforming them, they're conveying meaning to their fellow community members, but they're also conveying that meaning to outsiders that may be visiting from, you know, up or down the river valley, whatever the case may be.
Definitely. I'm kind of thinking of an example at Monte Alban in Oaxaca, Mexico. Various things you can look at there, the actual spatial layout of the main plaza, you know, kind of oriented north-south and very large. And then all of the buildings kind of surrounding the main plaza and even coursing through the center of the main plaza, would have had maybe something on the facade of them. I'm thinking specifically about Building J, which is this very enigmatic building kind of in the southern end of the main plaza, which had a bunch of what we call orthostats or finely carved stones on the facade that had depictions of what looked like little hill glyphs with these little inverted heads and some other calendrical glyphs on there. And that would have meant something to people in the past. And you can imagine, okay, well, what would it have been like to walk through the main plaza and to see these images on the wall, but in also trying to activate those spaces and think about, well, imagine now these Zapotec priests giving big speeches, you know, from the top of, you know, temple stairs and actually performing sacrifices, things like that. I think trying to think about that experience it kind of plays into that interpretive art of archaeology. You know, what would have felt like to walk through the space, seeing these things on the wall, but then also what would have it smelled like, you know, burning copal incense? What would it sounded like? And that's actually something we're working on now, is modeling sound propagation in urban spaces.
As you were talking, it makes me think of the cultural trail in Indianapolis. The idea that, you know, millions of years from now, someone is going to dig up Indianapolis and find the cultural trail, right? Find this sort of, you know, the bricks that show you where to go within the city, and think about kind of that again, that mix between human behavior and that search for beauty and that search for connection with others and connection to the natural world, right? That it's connected to the White River. So I think that it's cool just to think about all of these ways in which the behaviors that you're talking about sound in some ways very different, and then other ways very similar to the kinds of experiences that we have today. Thank you for sharing those stories and ideas.
Yeah, you know, what occurs to me too, when we're thinking about that, doesn't some of the art or the presentation of art or like ornamentation on body, on things, help you also sometimes with dating or knowing where something would be in time?
Yeah, absolutely. So we see different imagery, you know, in and among societies over time, and it changes, of course, you know, reflecting altering beliefs, political power, in and amongst a whole host of other variables. And so it, you know, here in the Midwest, where I do a majority of my archaeological research, you know, you will see from, say, 2,000 years ago to 1,000 years ago, different imagery being conveyed on different mediums, you know, everything from pottery, of course, through other objects.
Definitely. I'm ceramics are one we can point to right away. And I think that's kind of the bread and butter for a lot of archaeologists for dating sites. Typically, when you're doing archaeological survey, you're doing a lot of stuff on the surface. And in places like Mexico or even, you know, in South America and Peru, you often will find stuff right there on the surface that help you give a date to a rough date onto what those archaeologic sites are. For instance, in Peru, Middle Horizon ceramics, stuff from kind of Wari culture, are very different than what you see later on with Inca culture. So,
yeah, and that leads me to kind of ask the question about the idea of how did archaeologists early on, how did they ever figure out ways to find things? You know, now we have advanced imaging and we're going to get into that, but how did they do that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you look at the history of archaeological research in what I would just broadly call Eastern North America, you know, those pioneers of the 19th century or 1800s were certainly tackling the most obvious of sites. And so this might include something like geometric earthworks in the Ohio Valley that were studied by Squire and Davis, kind of one of the first publications ever by the Smithsonian Institution when it was founded. You know, but from that point moving forward, local knowledge plays a large role in finding archaeological sites. So whether that be a farmer here in the Midwest or an indigenous person where you might be working abroad, all of this is important to finding and ultimately conserving these resources, which are finite, right? Archaeology is about protecting sites as much as it is about learning from them too.
And I'd like to echo what Jeremy said there about local people, local knowledge. And I think today we try to emphasize, you know, how much that is a part of our practice. You know, when we go to a place, and local people often know the landscape much more than we do. And there's a lot of knowledge that they have. I think sometimes that gets obscured when we kind of project into early archaeology, where we often tell these stories about this one archaeologist who went to a place and they were the one who found the site. And now there's all these things named after them. I would like to echo that for sure. That's one way that early archaeologists would find, you know, archaeological sites, but also looking towards text, looking at history, and reading some of those early maps even usually helps to locate archaeological sites.
I think one of the powerful things that you both are just saying also when we think about it is local people, even many generations later, and if they've lived there for a long time, there is knowledge there that has been passed along. And so maybe sometimes some archaeologists in the past in their arrogance didn't think about that. But that certainly is something I'm sure that both of you teach students today, is there's knowledge, wisdom, and culture in the peoples that live where you're doing your research.
Certainly. I've actually had an interesting interplay between working with local people, but also looking at early texts. Often when we do archaeological survey, we're walking around with our guides who are from the place. They're often hunters because they know the trails and how to get from, you know, point A to point B. And they'll tell us place names in both Zapotec and also in Spanish. And when we have those place names recorded, later on when we go to the archives, oftentimes those place names show up and they help us kind of locate some of these places in the landscape if we haven't already located them.
Yeah, and just to echo that point, you know, working here in the farm fields of the Midwest, I have yet to meet a farmer that doesn't have at least a cigar box of artifacts from their fields. You know, they know the soils there better than anyone, and as they till them and as they plant their crops, they're looking down at the ground in much the same way that archaeologists do. It just so happens now that we have unique instruments that also allow us to visualize beneath the ground surface, but local knowledge is essential to finding sites.
And then beyond that, thinking towards what archaeologists have kind of brought to locating sites, they like to grid things off. Archaeologists love creating grids. Because it systematizes things. You know, you can place a grid over a map, and then the space is now organized so that you can go grid square by grid square searching and may be very systematic about it. Whether you're doing what we call full coverage, that would be searching every single grid square, or if you're sampling it in some way where you search, let's say, every other grid square or a random sample of those grid squares.
One of the things I think that's powerful that you're talking about there is sort of the idea of thinking about community expertise as a type of expertise to bring to the research process, that we as scientists, as social scientists, have a particular set of tools that is often about systems, that's often about a very structured method, and that you know, as you mentioned, Jeremy, you know, a farmer, a community member is going to have sort of different expertise to bring to the table. And it's those two types of expertise working together that really allows us to get closer to truth, to get closer to experience. I'm wondering, Alex, if you wouldn't mind kind of telling a story of a time when maybe you kind of went into a research project with a particular perspective, and maybe working with a community member changed that perspective a bit.
Think about that. Well, I mean, I've definitely had my perspective changed while doing archaeological survey with local people. Often we'll hire guides from the area, and we're walking around. And one time I was doing this thing called a least cost path analysis in ArcGIS. It's a program that allows us to do these modeling, but it's to model what would be the best way to traverse the landscape from point A to point B, right? Taking into account slope and direction, and maybe even some impediments like land cover. Well, that typically draws the line in some of these valley areas, right? So in lower places. While I'm walking around on survey though, I noticed, you know, local people there never give up elevation, and they usually walk the ridge lines in order to get from point A to point B. And they're telling me, why would we go down to the arroyo to actually walk to that place? Let's just take this hill, go down and up, and go to the, from this hill to that hill. And it kind of changed the way I started modeling that behavior on the computer. So I started to create a model that had people walk on higher locations rather than lower locations.
What a great example. Thank you for sharing. Jeremy, do you have a story to share?
Yeah, I was just thinking about Alex's mention of the geospatial modeling. And I think one of the things people would find a bit surprising is how many of our roads here in the United States are built atop trails that were previously kind of built by Native Americans, right? And so many of the US highways were kind of least cost paths that were found by, so to speak, Native Americans that had been, you know, traversing the land for thousands upon thousands of years. And we've done similar modeling where I work in Illinois. And it's funny to find these paths and then see from a historic map documenting in a quote unquote Indian trail. And then on top of that, there is a state or US highway today.
That's all just, you know, all this is so interesting, that especially the stories about thinking where you would walk, right? And I'm thinking my own journey of walking through the woods, and there might be, you know, my veering off because there's something beautiful or a waterfall. It might not be the most efficient path always, right? It might be something that I want to do. And so, Alex, that really hits.
Definitely. And actually, when you're mentioning that right there, there's something that I've learned that people do in Oaxaca, Mexico, and that's kind of these ritual pilgrimages. And this is where there is a sacred place in the landscape where people will go to that place and leave offerings there. And this can be a very large landform, like a big boulder, rock. It could be a natural spring. It could be a hilltop. But people will make these ritual pilgrimages. And I always wonder now, while I'm modeling these things in ArcGIS, you know, should I make it so that these things carry weight? Because people, if they're going to go from point A to point B, are probably going to stop at pilgrimage site X, Y, and Z as they go through the landscape.
Yeah, all this is so fascinating. We're talking with Dr. Jeremy Wilson and Dr. Alex Badijo, and we're talking about archaeology and culture, really, right now. When we return, we're going to have a little bit more conversation about remote sensing and how we can actually, in the modern era, find things. So please join us after a short break.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor, tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. I'm Krista Hoffman-Longton.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, and we're having a conversation about remote sensing in this second part of our show. And I wanted to start off that how did we ever even think of doing something like remote sensing? You guys, where did that come from?
Yeah, sure. So the first remote sensing devices start to be used in the Great Britain in the 1950s. And by the last few years of that decade, you see its application here in the Midwest as well. And so remote sensing is a broad term, and we also sometimes call it geophysics. And it's basically trying to detect things that are beneath the ground surface. And the way I oftentimes relate this to students, if they've seen the movie before, is the intro to Jurassic Park, the original movie, where they are in fact in paleontological beds, and they, it's science fiction, mind you, but they're able to visualize a dinosaur that's beneath the ground surface. And to that kind of same approach, that's what archaeologists do with the instruments we have today.
Yeah, and I'm kind of thinking also of the remote sensing where we're imaging things from high up above. You know, since we've been able to use airplanes and even take pictures from high up, from even balloons, we've been able to operationalize that technology. You know, if you take a picture from above, you're going to see everything in a much larger extent, which might even bring up very different questions about what you're seeing there on the ground. So, you know, looking at technologies of airplanes, but now even drones, these days we have these things which we in our archaeological community are calling unmanned aerial vehicles. Really, it's just, you know, we call them drones. Everybody knows them as drones, but they're just blowing up, and this, not actually blowing up, but, you know, they're becoming more and more popular, and they're actually very useful and there's, I believe we're going to see more of a boom in LiDAR technology down the road because of this.
You know, I think that's really interesting, that idea of looking from above. And, you know, there's questions I'm sure you guys still have now that archaeologists had a long time ago, which was, why did somebody create something like earthworks or designs in it? And how did they do that? Because, you know, they didn't have the ability to be above. Meaning, who are they doing it for, and all that. So I, Alex, I get the idea that when you get some perspective on something, you start to go, wait a minute, there might be more to this than I think.
Right. I mean, just a simple camera on the end of a pole and putting it up in the air really high and taking that photo is such a great tool in archaeology, you know, and now we can do it with drones, which makes it even easier, but it definitely changes the way you think about the site as a whole, which then will kind of influence your questions down the road later.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I'm thinking here with LiDAR, you know, whether it be plane or drone based or whatever the case may be, of course, the laser's going down to the ground surface and therefore measuring distance based upon the time it takes to get back. But what's really impressive is how subtle features on the landscape that may almost be imperceivable to the naked eye, so to speak, even if you were flying in that plane with that laser device, can be magnified in the software to kind of elucidate or show those subtle changes in very impactful ways.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the interplay too between these various types of remote sensing technologies. You know, we can be in the air and start to see things on the ground, whether it's through taking photos or using LiDAR to measure the different elevations and those subtle changes on the Earth's surface. But I mean, Jeremy can tell you more about remote sensing to look under the ground, because once you get that hint of what might actually be there under the ground, that's what we can get into those technologies.
Jeremy, before you jump into that, I'm wondering for some of our listeners who are not familiar, I think that LiDAR is an acronym. Is that right? Can you tell us what it stands for?
Yeah, Alex can take this one. He uses LiDAR.
Oh, thanks, Alex. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Light detection and ranging. And so this is using a device and using an active sensor, which is shooting lasers down to the Earth's surface. And it's making that measurement, right? And this doesn't necessarily have to be airborne. You know, whether it's by plane or drone, it can actually be something that's set on the ground on a tripod. And so we have those as well, where, you know, that's a little, you can imagine it's like a little device where a laser shot out into a mirror and the mirror is spinning really fast. And so it sprays all of these points outward, you know, in 360 degrees. And then it just maps an entire room or an entire landscape, but from the ground instead.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. So you're talking about many, many little points of laser light hitting and then coming back to a sensor. What's amazing to me then, Alex, is that you've also coupled that hardware idea with the software of geographic information systems, which when you couple those together, you're able then to peel away some things.
Right. Yeah. It's so if you can imagine taking a LiDAR data set, let's imagine one that was taken by an airplane, and we put it into GIS, geographic information system, and we can actually have the computer either automate or manually classify those returns. Now, what I mean by that is every time we shoot a laser out of that airplane and hits the ground and comes back, it creates a point on the Earth or on whatever surface it actually hits and gets reflected back. So now you have to imagine there's millions of points that create this big, what we call point cloud. And that point cloud is what can be manipulated in GIS software, where you can, let's just make it easier. You just tell the computer, well, I need these returns, the stuff that's the ground level, and it'll give you that. Or computer, I want to know what the tree canopy is like and what the height of all those trees are like. And so with a laser, because you have millions of lasers coming out of that airplane and hitting the ground, sometimes you'll get returns at the top of the tree. Sometimes you'll get about mid-level of the tree and back up, and then also hitting the ground surface and back up. And so those various returns can be classified in different ways so that you can create a different elevation model based on what you want to see. So it could be all the buildings and the trees, or it could be just the bare earth model.
So hearing about this technology is new to me as somebody who doesn't work in this field. Can you talk a little bit about what some of the advantages and disadvantages are to having technology like this? I mean, I would think for starters, you wouldn't have to dig as much, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think remote sensing technology in the most general of sense has really changed the way we go about finding archaeological sites. This is particularly true in, you know, kind of big river valleys, where even a site that may have been occupied, say, 100 years ago, could be, you know, a half foot to a foot below the ground surface and imperceivable. And so there's a number of instruments that we have that are generally called remote sensing, but they include ground penetrating radar and magnetometry. And in both of those cases, you're either walking or pushing a device around a landscape and you're collecting data, right? And so with that and a computer on hand, you can actually visualize what's below the ground surface without having to move any earth. And so this is, as I said before, fundamentally changed the game for archaeologists working around the world.
It definitely has. I can also imagine, I can see, you know, in the work that we do, we're getting a lot of information with fewer resources and without having to kind of disturb the earth and, you know, disturb any of those cultural resources that are there in the ground. But on the flip side of it is, at least with data from LiDAR, but also photogrammetric data, we have so much to deal with when it comes to memory and storage. You know, now we have millions and at times billions of points to save, or imagery. If we take, you know, thousands of photos from above with a drone, we have to store them somewhere. And so that's kind of the more difficult part of it to manage, I could say.
Yeah,
go ahead, Mark.
Go ahead, Kristen.
I was going to say, and to some extent takes a really different set of skills, right? Like that, so that what you're teaching students has changed really dramatically, I would imagine, from, you know, even 20 years ago to today.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think about all of my my graduate students, and most of them now, where say 20 years ago, they would have been focused on artifactual analyses, like looking at arrowheads or pottery. They're still doing that, of course, but they're also learning a technical skill, whether that be GIS, as Alex mentioned before, or some remote sensing equipment that gets applied to a known archaeological site. So we can learn a little bit more at the same time that the student is getting a technical skill set that, you know, to be perfectly honest, is going to make them employable, you know, moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what I was going to say, you really have different levels here. With LiDAR, you're kind of trying to get above that, even if it's at ground, but you're trying to get, maybe there's some mounds or some differences in elevation, something that would make you have a hint that there's something going on there. And then when you get to your almost, you've said it before, but I think, Jeremy, your lawnmower kind of thing that you push around on the surface, then you're able to probe even deeper into there. And I love the idea that maybe that means that we don't have to disturb as much as we used to, particularly some critical sites where culturally that would be really negative.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so I'm thinking about this juxtaposition between Alex and I right now, where he may be flying his drone and looking up at it while it's looking down at the ground, whereas I'm holding a device and walking it across the surface. And regardless of the data set that we get back, we're learning a lot about the archaeological site and therefore can target very specific areas to answer our research questions. You know, you compare us to, say, 19th century archaeologists, they would open up, you know, acres of an archaeological site and not, to be perfectly honest, have good research questions in mind. Whereas today we might be opening, you know, a series of 1 by 1 meter or 1 by 1 yard units and be able to answer our research questions because we've targeted specific areas, right? And so we're able to conserve that archaeological site for future generations of researchers, but then also descendant communities.
Definitely. And the word I would often use is we can then be surgical about it later. You know, we can really hone in on what we need to look at and excavate instead of just opening the entire thing. You know, if we find a structure, we can be targeting, let's say, the north wall of the structure instead of the whole structure.
I think it's really interesting because, Krista, in your area in the medical school, we sort of do the same thing. I mean, surgeries are getting to where we try to make them less and less invasive, less and less invasive in terms of diagnostics. So it would seem there's a lot of parallels between remote sensing here and in medicine.
Absolutely. I mean, when you think about the kinds of skills that I teach medical students from a communication standpoint, those skills have actually changed quite a bit, in part because my medical students are using things like ultrasound in the emergency room as a diagnostic tool, right? We think of ultrasound as something that pregnant women get to make sure that their baby's well and healthy. But, you know, point of care ultrasound, you can now get an ultrasound that connects to your, you know, your smartphone. And you can use that in a very easy way in a remote situation where we're maybe trying to figure out, you know, a break of a bone, for example, or something like that, so that we know how to best field set it, so that when that person can get the care they need, that they can do so with minimal damage. And so when you're talking about teaching students, like, you know, like Alex and Jeremy, there are things that I teach students now about how do we talk about technology differently with patients, which I imagine is true for you as you go out and work with people in the community, that for folks that live relatively rural lives, it probably looks pretty scary for you all to show up with a drone and a bunch of other sort of materials. So I would, you know, as a communication scholar, I'm always interested in, you know, how do you build those relationships? How are you talking about this technology in a way that doesn't feel invasive, but in fact, in your case, is actually making your work less invasive?
I have some examples from Mexico and working with the drone. I feel like when I did do some research there early on, let's say 2016, I brought a drone with me, and it was relatively new at the time, and so there were very few people who had really worked with or seen drones that were living there in the town. So I immediately took it to town authorities and made sure it was part of our permissions that we can bring this device in here and that we can fly it overhead and scan the landscape. And we're using photogrammetry, so we're just taking pictures of the landscape. But it was kind of difficult to convey the message that I'm going to take thousands of photos and then we're going to process that and make a whole 3D landscape of, you know, whatever. And so I did struggle with that there in the beginning, but it really, using visual techniques to explain something and being prepared to show someone visually what something does goes a long way. Because, you know, we can say things with our words, but sometimes it just, you have to see it to understand, okay, this is what's going on here.
It's funny, whenever I teach medical students about those concepts, I always remind them that pediatricians have been doing this for years, right? That the first thing a pediatrician does with a child is hand them an otoscope, right? Before they look in their eyes or look in their ears, they say like, look, it won't hurt you. You can play with it. You can look at it. And I think that a lot of those same techniques still hold in many different places where you're bringing new technology to folks. Jeremy, you were going to mention something.
Yeah, I would just build upon Alex's point there. Working with landowners and mostly farmers, of course, I identify myself first as an archaeologist, and they're apprehensive. On one level, they think I might have some claim to their land and that the state or the government may take it, which is in fact not true. But then second, they're also worried about the impact to their crops or something like that. And then all of a sudden I pull out a device that is just, simply an aluminum superstructure with two plastic tubes, and we just start walking back and forth, right, in their field. And then we're done in a couple days. And the landowners are like, is that it? That's not it. But, here's this really cool image of what's beneath your farm field. And the goal really is to build a sense of stewardship with these landowners. And it's been so surprising over the 10 or so years that I've been doing remote sensing to see how much these landowners, these farmers, come to be protectors of the archaeological sites that are on their properties.
Yeah, I think that's, something I used to do ballooning with friends in my younger days. But one of the things we learned, and talking about protection, usually you're going out and you don't know where you're going to land, right? Depends on what weather conditions, depends on the fuel you have left. And so we regularly had a thing of whiskey in that basket, because if we landed and took down some farmer's part of his corn crop, we had to contend with that he was protecting that crop. Anyway, I can imagine the same kind of thing. There has to be some way of, working with the protector of that land and saying, okay, I'm okay. It's an okay guy. Just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersection between art and science. We encourage you to explore these ideas further in conversation with others and any of the ideas that we explored in today's show. We'll be right back.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
This is Dave Baghdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation about visualization, what lies beneath the surface, and remote sensing technology. I'm Krista Hoffman-Longton. Alex, I understand that you use a very particular type of photography to understand more about what's beneath the surface and use that to kind of do your work. So can you talk a little bit more about the strategies that you use?
Sure. So in our conversation today, we're talking a lot about LIDAR, which is kind of an active sensor shooting lasers down to measure distance. But there's also another technique that not a lot of people know about, but it's called structure for motion photogrammetry. And this is the ability to take multiple 2D photos of a 3D phenomena, in the real world. This could be an object all the way up to an entire landscape. Take that series of photos, put it into the computer, and have it produce a 3D digital model. And so this is all something that can be measured. So if it's a ceramic vessel, it can be measured with precision. It could be cut in half digitally, so you could look at the form of the vessel. Or if it's a landscape, we can put it in a GIS, just like LIDAR data, and actually explore it in those ways, seeing kind of the subtle differences in elevation, maybe look at the actual ortho image, which is the kind of a, you can picture it as a photorealistic image spread over that landscape, and see maybe even changes in vegetation visually. But I like to talk about it with LIDAR just because it produces very similar data. When we're getting point clouds from LIDAR data that have various returns, in photogrammetric data, we create point clouds from all of those photos taken together. And the computer does this by calculating those angles and distances to whatever the source of light is, or the source of the reflectance.
When I hear you talk about that, that reminds me of some of the work that we know folks do to do things like animation, right? So when you think about, we mentioned Jurassic Park earlier, right? Creating one of those dinosaurs from Jurassic Park, that it's actually, you know, a model that they then use a green screen to create that model and give it the opportunity to move. And it sounds like in a lot of ways that having all of this photographic evidence gives you a really clear picture of what you're trying to study. And I would assume gives you more data to be able to determine what it was used for, how it might shape kind of what else is in that space. What else do you use? What else do you use this technology for?
So that's exactly right. So not only does it create something that looks almost identical to the real thing because it's wrapped in a photorealistic texture, right? But it's also scientifically measurable. So you can make it to scale, or you can rescale it and put it into a different virtual environment. But a good example of somebody who used this in a very effective way, I believe it was Terry Hunt, another archaeologist who worked in Rapa Nui, Easter Island, basically 3D printed one of those statues to try to do experimental archaeology and understand how those things were moved from one place to another. And that was using a photogrammetric model.
What a great example. I think it also gives us a sense of having sort of a very clear picture of something allows us to some extent to be able to think about and look at the past. And I understand, Jeremy, that you have a project in which you have sort of thought about looking at the history of a particular cemetery in this way. Can you tell us more about that project?
Yeah, sure. So here I'm speaking about the Bethel Cemetery relocation project, which was undertaken in 2018. And at that time, I had just met Alex and knew of his expertise in structure from motion photogrammetry. And the project entailed the exhumation of a 19th century cemetery here in Indianapolis. And so one of our concerns was, of course, that we had to exhume these individuals and that we were, in essence, destroying the cemetery, right? Archaeology is a destructive process. That is not to say that we were destroying the bodies, but the cemetery was going to be moved. And so with Alex on board, we were able to do photogrammetry of the cemetery before any trees or headstones or bodies were removed. And so what we now have, and we can share with community members and descendants, is the virtual immersive model of Bethel Cemetery as it existed prior to the excavation.
Yeah, we've recorded. I was just going to say we've recorded the whole thing, you know, the whole surface plus all of the headstones. And then as we were excavating, we used the photogrammetry to record our archaeological context as well. Obviously, we don't use those in any sort of public engagement, but it is nice to have the whole cemetery to be revisited digitally.
Yeah, what I was going to say, and this loops us back into some things you guys said earlier about the idea of having a lot of data. You know, you've got a lot of data points, you've collected a lot of images. On the other hand, besides the storage issues, you have it. So we don't know, you may not be doing something destructive, but we don't know if there'll be a natural thing that would be destructive that will come along, or even a human-made thing where somebody might do something. And now at least, as versus the past, we will have a digital record of it prior to that.
Yeah, it has, photogrammetry has really functioned well in that respect. And even in the, I'd say in the 5-6 years I've been doing photogrammetry, I've For instance, in Oaxaca, Mexico, at Monte Albán, there was an earthquake in 2017. And that was just after we had recorded all of this. And there was a lot of destruction at the site. We had the Mesoamerican ball court there. The whole south side of that was destroyed and fell in. We recorded it beforehand, and I also recorded it afterwards, and you can see those differences. And since it is something that's scientifically measurable, it can be used for restoration purposes too.
The things that strikes me about having these data, and Mark, you sort of alluded to some of the, you know, there are positive and negative implications associated with having all of these data, right? That you know, there are certainly things that folks get from being able to re-envision that place, but it also means that you've got, you know, in this case, the sort of digital data of individuals' remains, right? Family members of people who have, you know, lived well before us. I think the thing that is powerful for me, though, is just the extent to which having these very robust visual data may change people's perceptions of a physical space. I'm thinking as we're talking about the ways in which hearing the recordings of whale sounds that were recorded in the 70s and early 80s changed the way we think about conserving whales, right? That we think about conservation around the sea. And so I'm wondering if you've seen with your students or even with community members that having these really rich, strong visualizations changes people's perceptions of your work or of a site?
Yeah, I it's a really great question. I think we're on the precipice of some really impressive advancements in the way we experience cultural heritage sites, meaning we don't have to visit them anymore, though we might want to. I certainly want to go to Monte Albán. But Monte Albán can be delivered to you in a virtual or augmented reality. And as Alex spoke about in the first segment, beyond the visuals, imagine if we can add the layers of perception, including noise and then even smell, right? And as an educator, of course, I then pivot to thinking about the educational impacts of having a fully immersive experience so that students can understand what these places were like, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, or whatever the case may be.
Definitely useful for education, definitely useful for public outreach and understanding. I'm thinking even of the Bethel Cemetery project. We had somebody pull together headstones from the same family and create these little family visits where you could actually see the headstones from that family. And we made it in a way where somebody, an older person, could maybe sit in a chair and just put on the glasses and just kind of look around and not have to move or use any other controllers. But, you know, with kind of what Jeremy mentioned there, at Monte Albán, we've actually made it into a virtual reality experience and an environment. And you can hear things and you can see things and feel the monumentality of a lot of those structures. But down the road, we're going to be able to incorporate the other senses too. And it was interesting that Jeremy said smell, because that's something that people are working on now, using virtual reality, incorporating even more senses than just touch, sight, and sound, but even using other technologies that create smells within that environment that are triggered when you walk towards a certain location in the virtual world.
Yeah, and you know, that's been the holy grail. My background's in museums. It's been the holy grail of museums for a long time to do that. And I remember in the 1980s at the Children's Museum, we experimented in one of the galleries around where the trading post was with creating smells within there that would give you the feel of what the trading post was like, you know, the kind of fireplace, but also animal smells. And it made for a totally different experience.
Certainly does. Even the feel of heat or cold or wind adds to the experience. And these are things that I know that IUPUI, there's a fellow by the name of Chauncey Friend, and he's already incorporating these things in virtual reality.
That's really amazing.
The other thing that I think that's so powerful about that is going back to this relationship between emotion and learning, right? The idea of, I love, if you've not read Sarah Rose Kavanaugh's book, The Spark of Learning, that She's a neuroscientist, and she looks at the relationship between emotion and learning. We know that there are very strong relationships between the emotions that someone feels and their willingness to engage in a particular topic, willingness to remember a particular topic. And so I think as we think about what the future of these spaces look like, to me, it offers really exciting opportunities to get community members and students engaged in a project that maybe might not be in the realm of their experience until they have this chance to do that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think in the next decade or so, we're gonna see fundamental changes in how we teach and engage with the stakeholders that are interested in the archaeology that we do.
And I was just having a call earlier today with a development team in England, and we were talking about developing more for this virtual reality experience at Montalban, but gamifying. And I think that's something that we're going to see more in the future, as gamification of these archaeological sites. And that's not to make light of the site and kind of laugh at it and create a game. It's more to engage the users and make it more interactive. So being able to take a multi-ton stone with your hand and put it on the facade and take another one, and then let's say rearrange that visual program to be something that may have been used in the past, is definitely engaging for students.
What I love is the idea that you're getting closer to merging what would be real in terms of the science and the real environment with the gaming environment. And that's a very powerful concept and a really good thought. I want to thank both of you, Dr. Jeremy Wilson and Dr. Alex Badillo. And we want to thank you for exploring the hidden world that's under our feet. It's so fascinating to look into the past and to see all of the instrumentation and tools.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just so that our listeners know, they'll have an opportunity to find pictures of these projects and projects from other guests of the Da Vinci Pursuit website at thedavincipursuit.com, where we create museums without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations.
And until then, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again next week when we explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedavincipursuit.com.